in some experts in order to start a dialogue among people with different points of view so that we could make sure we carefully considered our options here in Alachua County about what we could improve. So the first one was on water and wetlands. The second one was on natural resources. And this, the third and last, is on what we're calling the built environment. So the built environment, we're defining as anything that man has produced inside our county. So I'm gonna let Nam introduce the panel, but first I wanna talk about what our ground rules are in case this is the first time you've attended this particular event. We are taking questions from the audience via text or via a written comment. So if you don't have access to text on your phone, just write the comment down and bring it up to me. We're gonna type it up here. And that way, Nam, as moderator, can interject that question in at the right point in time, or that point, if you don't have a question. We are not here to talk about any specific developments, so we're not bringing up any specific developments in this conversation. So this is a general discussion about development in all of Alachua County. The third ground rule is that we all stay, well, we're allowed to disagree, and it's actually, we encourage people to disagree because that's what makes it interesting. We're asking everyone to please keep it civil and nice. And in the last trip, it was very nice, so I hope this one stays the same. And with that in mind, also feel free to get up at any point in time, refill your glass, get something to eat. The bathrooms are out that door and to the right, and you'll see a little hallway, and the bathrooms are at the end of the hallway. There's also a water fountain down there if we run out of drinks. That's it. So enjoy yourselves. And I need to call the meeting to order. This is an official EPAC meeting, so I'd like to call the meeting to order. And is there a
motion to adopt the agenda?
Yeah, a motion to adopt the agenda. That's right.
So adopt the agenda.
So moved. Okay. All in favor?
Aye.
Okay. We are moving forward. Turn the floor over to Nam.
Thanks, Mary. Welcome, everyone. Again, just to kind of touch on a couple of points, we do have a couple openings on EPAC. So, in case it wasn't clear, as Mary said, this is a series of conversation events has been organized by EPAC, which is one of the county's Environmental Protection Advisory Committees, or the Environmental Protection Advisory Committee, one of many committees for the county. So we do have a number of openings. We'd love you to join and participate if you're interested. So again, just plugging our committee. To kind of introduce the panelists now, we wanted to get a mix of folks from the county and from the community. So we have folks from University of Florida, folks from the sort of business professional side, and then also from sort of non-profit government as well. So to start, we have, and I think it's just alphabetical, I can't actually remember the list I have here, but we have Stuart Cullen, Vice President of George F. Young, PE Lead Green Associate. If you want to just raise your hand or stand up. We have Ruth Steiner, a professor and director of the Center for Health and Built Environment at University of Florida, PhD MBA. We have Glenn Acom Fasla, senior lecturer at UF, Department of Landscape Architecture. And then Ivan Ulrich, president of Ulrich Construction Incorporated. And finally, but not least, Teresa Sperling Wood, energy conservation specialist at Alachua County Public Schools, CIE, GP, and LEED AP. As Mary mentioned, the whole goal here is to be pretty informal. We're gonna have a series of questions that we've put together via conversations with the panelists, with members of the community, and we're just gonna kind of start rolling. Just a little bit of a framing before we start, though. Essentially, we wanted to kind of, as Mary said, look at what can and should be changed and kind of using the frame of where are we right now. So we kind of grouped the questions into, as much as possible, two bunches. We have kind of where are we now, and specifically I think we titled that where are we now and what are the current problems or challenges, and then finally, what do we need to change, where do we need to go, how do we address these problems. So again, we're going to kind of start off with that first group and just kind of work our way through. We don't expect every panelist to answer every question, and if the panelists want to discuss amongst themselves once a topic gets going, feel free to do that, and I'll just try and interject to keep the conversation moving. So, to begin, and let's maybe start off with Teresa here, if you don't mind. What are the barriers to rating systems such as ENERGY STAR, LEED, Florida Green Building Certification, and Florida Water Star? What are the barriers that there may be locally to these being widely utilized or more embraced by the builders or public? Anything that you can specifically mention there?
Some of the barriers are actual contractor training. Some of the barriers are actual contractor training events so that they get up to speed, like with ENERGY STAR and the changes with that, with building the code changes and keeping them all to speed and getting certified for a lot of that with the ENERGY STAR. So that's one of the biggest ones.
Okay. Any follow-up from any of the members? Yeah. Ivan, something you want to say?
Yeah, I would suggest that one of the biggest barriers is an economic viability of doing projects that, you know, LEED is a great thing, it does all kinds of great things, but it certainly adds cost to a project. And when you get into, you know, private sector stuff and, you know, money, it gets down to the dollars and cents, sometimes those things can be, that's certainly a barrier.
Stuart?
Well, in addition to that, we see that majority of the design is actually done to these systems, but a lot of them aren't rated. And the barrier to actually being in that system is getting into the certification process or engaging the professionals to be in that certification process, when actually the design itself, the majority of the time, are already based on the most sustainable practices and within those systems. They're just not signed up, so to speak, in those systems themselves.
Anyone else?
Yeah, it's a good idea.
One of my concerns is actually that what we're dealing with sometimes is a general tool for we always complain about plans for being inflexible, and I think that's a challenge with some of these rating systems. And you can see evidence of it by the proliferation of extensions of LEED, for instance. You have LEED MD because LEED doesn't really deal with the location within the community. You have sites for LEED, which is dealing with the water consumption and other low impact development. And the tricky part there is really figuring out what's the best thing for the context in which you're implementing it.
Anyone else?
I'll make one brief comment. I mean, like many things, it's to me, a suite of tools. You select the tools that best meet your needs, and within the metrics that you have, you can achieve the level of LEED certification. One of the dilemmas is that the tools could be chosen that have some effects that are not as desirable as others. And the comment that I find that I make from time to time is sometimes one can make some damaging choices and still attain LEED certification because you have the ability to choose those areas that you can succeed in. The bottom line, however, is that it's the best we have, and it certainly has, at least for now, it certainly gives us a chance to have some high-performance buildings with the clientele that can afford to do it.
I just want to add that when I was talking about the training, I'm talking about the technicians, the tradesmen out in the field. If they don't get the training where they understand and know how to build to any of these specifications, you're going to have a great design, you're going to have a great program, but your mechanic is not going to install it the way it needs to be done. So we need more training of the actual technicians in the field for how to build and do things. I mean, we have a big gap there. We did a lot of home performance with ENERGY STAR, using existing homes and the things we found in the market that's here of some of the lower income or houses markets that were already here had so many problems, and when you have guys that, or women, or whoever, I'm an air conditioning mechanic myself, so for 34 years, I've been putting in air conditioner systems. When it changed, if I wasn't involved in getting the training and the education, then I didn't know how to function well with the new systems, and we have a workforce that needs more training to keep up with all these. We can design and make great systems and great ratings, but if the mechanics and the workforce doesn't truly understand how to put it together and make it function, we won't make the changes that we need to. So that's one of my biggest things. You have to be licensed to be a beautician, but you can install an air conditioner system without a license. Your contractor will have the license, but the mechanic themselves doesn't. So it's just kind of an interesting thing.
Two quick follow-ups from some of the community in the room. Just anyone who wants to respond to these, do you think that the builder and maybe say the builder community here see value in these programs? And then also, UF has embraced green building. Would that not indicate economic viability? So thoughts on, is the use of that an indicator that it is economically viable? Anybody? Stuart?
Can we take that microphone?
Sure,
too?
Yeah.
Maybe
I think I probably talk loud enough without
there.
Assistance.
There's hats. There you go.
Trying this one also, does that help? I guess addressing the second one first, the economic viability in a University of Florida building is not the same thing as addressing economic viability in a regular commercial building or residents themselves. The University of Florida has embraced green building, and it is for the long-term life cycle costs of the buildings and that aspect of things, and not necessarily the economic return of the buildings themselves. So it's the life cycle aspect and the quality of the environment itself in the buildings for the users, not whether it's going to actually make a return. And that's where we're talking about the costs themselves of these LEED systems actually cost and don't necessarily benefit or don't necessarily meet the exact standards that you would design to otherwise because of the way the rating systems are set up. That, like Glenn was saying, is that you find a desire to meet it in order to gain the points in the particular system, and it may not be the best design or the best aspect in order to either be economically viable or the best design, but it's how the system is set up, and we have to work with it.
If I might just chime in there real quick, isn't there at least some research out there that shows while the upfront costs may be more, in the long term, if you do look at, as you mentioned, the life cycle of the building, whether it's in energy savings or water savings, that you do actually come out at least, you know, ahead or in the black and not, you know, in the red, so to speak?
Yes, is the quick answer. But I want to answer the first question first. Do builders see value in it? Absolutely. There's, construction has been, you know, with new innovation and stuff, steady for so many years. And it's a recent, there's all kinds of new products and techniques and exciting stuff coming out based on environmentally friendly and sensitive type products. And that's really cool, and new ways to do stuff and better ways to build a building. And so the answer to the first question is absolutely. And to echo what Stuart said and what Nam was asking, it's all about longevity for a government entity. You know, UF's a government entity. And for the record, most of the work that Old Ridge Construction does is commercial work for the university, for the county, city, in commercial buildings. We don't build houses, I guess what I'm ultimately saying. But it's about, to echo what Stuart said, it's about the University of Florida's going to have buildings for 100 years. Are they going to make that energy savings up over that? Absolutely. The county's going to have buildings for a long time. But I don't know where the fall off is a developer, he's going to build a strip mall, and he's going to develop it, get it full, and then he's going to sell it. And does he ever get that return? You know, I don't know that math works.
Okay. Anyone else before we move on? Ruth?
I want to talk about various aspects of the programs because I think it's fair to say that we tend to focus on the energy savings and the embedded energy in the building, but I don't think we're as far along in thinking about water efficiency and even more importantly, location efficiency. I go ballistic when I hear somebody talking about building a green building in the middle of nowhere. because that person is going to spend a heck of a lot of time driving to get where they're going, and they're going to be consuming fossil fuel, petroleum-based, the majority of the time.
So maybe just to kind of move on and kind of follow along with that, what is the current state of pedestrian, bicycle, multimodal mobility in Alachua County with regards to either our comprehensive plan or current development? Ruth, maybe you want to chime in there?
Very good question. This is going to sound like a shameless plug, but I got a call from a reporter with the Gainesville Sun who's ready to start writing about this, so I have the advantage of thinking about this morning. I think the challenge we have is that the county in some respects has planned better for transit-oriented development than the city, which is quite unfortunate. But I also think we haven't put all the pieces together. For instance, if most of you that live near where you could use transit, I'll generalize from my own situation. I literally either have to walk an extra half mile to get across the street, across a 5-lane roadway that has a 45-mile-hour speed limit, and people are driving around 55 miles an hour. So our pedestrian, we need to do a lot more on connecting. Multimodality, intermodality really implies ease of movement from one mode to the next. And I think that's really the next frontier in what we're going to have to do. A piece of that also is the land development patterns. And the challenge is that most of our residential is too low density. It's too high density to not have traffic accumulating, but it's too low density to support good transit, except with a few exceptions. And even more so, the other problem is that we have this, I know this was changed in the plan, but we have this tendency to have single entrances into subdivisions. So we concentrate 100% of the traffic on a single roadway. You know the roadways I'm talking about, 39th Avenue, 43rd, 53rd. And then we wonder why we have congestion when 100% of the people living there have really no choice of how they're going to get around in our community other than driving.
Any other panelists want to add anything to that point?
Particularly in Alachua County, the Land Development Code does provide for a good basis and future development of multimodality. The issue that we see on the design side of that is the practical use of that modality versus the actual use of it. For instance, in-street bike lanes versus sidewalks for bicyclists. We see that most bicyclists are not using the sidewalks if we have a multi-use path, and if we're using a share lane, they're using the share lane where they should be. So the use of those is a better choice. However, our corridor design manuals require us to put sidewalks on both sides, even though there may not be any pedestrians because of the distance that it may be utilized or for the future applicability of doing it. So although the plan allows for it and creates it and desires it, the practical use and the practical aspect of recognizing where and how it's best is not necessarily allowed in the plan because it's so rigid.
Teresa?
one of the things that I've noticed with Alachua County Public Schools is students don't have a way around the county. If they don't have somebody to drive them, they can't get a bus from Newberry, Archer, Hawthorne, and come into town to do anything. There is no transportation for them except for somebody to drive them back and forth. We should have some way, a park and ride lot where they can ride their bicycle or park their car and come into town. Coming in shouldn't be everybody get in their car. You know, if we could stop a lot of that traffic and let the kids have the opportunity to use a bus system to get into town, I mean, what an education point that is. They come in for graduation. Anybody been around town for graduation? High school graduations? I mean, it's hours and hours. If we had a bus system that would come from Newberry or, you know, rotating, and so people could ride buses to come into town to go to the O'Connell Center, or on Saturdays where the kids could come from out on another town into Gainesville to to do things, go to the movies, go to games. We can't get those systems going. I know it's a cost thing, but coming down 121, it's like a freeway. You know, everybody coming from Lake Butler into La Crosse, how come there's not a park and ride there? You know how many people would park and ride to get to the bus system if they could park up in Lake Butler or La Crosse and come into town that way? Is there research on that? Just things like that to make it where we don't have everybody coming in and we start getting that flow going. We could change the way everybody travels in the future.
Just one challenge and one conversation about park and rides is that they may contribute to sprawl because they allow people to live further up. I want to go to the point of emphasize the importance of distinguishing between, and a challenge that I think we have is we're so accustomed to planning for one mode of travel instead of for all modes of travel together. And so when I hear statements, and I'm going to challenge you on this, that we don't need sidewalks on both sides of the street, I'm going to raise a question that many of you may never thought of. We routinely stop bicycle and pedestrian facilities and leave few choices for the user of those facilities. Yet we would never think of dropping an automobile lane from one lane to zero because we just don't do that. In order to really think about getting our systems to work together in a multimodal manner, we need to think complete streets, we need to think connectivity, we need to think network effects. When I hear people saying, well, nobody's going to use that road because bicyclists would rather be on the sidewalk, the problem is in high pedestrian areas, bicyclists are not going to be happy on that sidewalk. And until we start thinking about connecting places in this county where bicyclists are going with all of the other places in the county where bicyclists are using, we're not going to maintain achieve the kind of intermodality and the opportunities. Just going back to this inlay lane there, we did a natural experiment in this community when we striped bicycle lanes on 34th Street. And the numbers aren't huge because a lot of us, and I put myself in this category, would not run a bicycle along 34th Street with cars right next to us. But believe it or not, the numbers of bicyclists increased substantially along that corridor when we added a bike lane. So if you want to talk about the importance of those facilities, if you don't have them, you can't ride them.
So moving on, given the following examples, namely, Alachua County has been recognized by the state as being at the forefront in terms of comprehensive planning for things like strategic ecosystem protection and incorporation of multimodal transportation, particularly around transit-oriented development. The comprehensive plan goes beyond state regulations in restricting development in wetlands. And given that in terms of wetland protection, buffer areas are actually more restrictive than those from the Water Management District, are there ways that these or other regulations should be changed to be more or less stringent than state regulations, or more in line or less in line? Any thoughts from any of the panelists on that question?
Myself in trouble, but I'd much rather Alachua County be in charge of our regulations than the state. And at in the current situation with the water management districts, I feel the same way. I think I'd be happiest if we were to adopt a new stormwater rule. That was supposed to happen about 6 years ago, and it didn't. And at that point, I think that would have been a lot more of an encouragement for state leadership and so on. But I'm quite happy that we have Alachua County setting the regulatory guidelines. And for any of the discrepancies or concerns we have, we can change it a lot easier at the local level.
Anyone else want to add in to that?
I do. Go ahead, you go first.
I'm sorry.
I don't know a lot about the wetlands and the regulations, but I do know I get a lot of feedback from friends of mine who are doing projects and things, and one of their biggest complaints is between the county and the EPD and everybody, they all need to sit down and have a conversation together and get all the rules the same so that they're not going from one entity to another to another and getting bounced around with different rules. So there needs to be more conversation within city and county and regulations and permitting so that people don't spend a year or 2 years trying to get through a permit process. And that's just feedback I've gotten from friends trying to do things.
Stuart.
That's an excellent point, is the multi-different views of the process in the any of the design process involving wetlands. There are a handful of permits we have to get from federal all the way down to local. And when we live in a society with the bureaucratic aspect that we do, it's hard to shift all the responsibility to a location. However, I do believe that the locality is the ones that have the best knowledge in order to understand those systems, as long as there is the interaction with the other style systems. Your county's borders is not where the wetlands and the streams and the rivers and everything stop. They move into all our adjacent counties. And then the Florida borders don't stop at the Georgia line or any of the other westerly states. We move on up. So the interaction with all of those have to have some sort of oversight. So how do you, it's very difficult to say that Electric County can have its control of only its borders. And that's because of the political boundary border that was drawn, and that's where we stop. And the reality is an interaction between those agencies all on the same common goal is an important aspect in order to make sure that they are have the flexibilities within each of their systems, but also allow for it to be recognized in the comprehensive area of the, whether it's a local issue or whether it's an interconnected issue with the all the way up to the federal level.
What came to mind when I saw this was that what I believe, if we really care about conservation of our strategic ecosystems and other things we value, in a place like Florida that's growing so rapidly, we need to get the urban development right. And I think the challenge for the county is that it, in some respects, there's an argument that most of that development should take place in the city, and until recently, the county was not really allowing very high development. Thankfully, that's changed, but I think and the clustered development and a number of those tools are really useful. It is too bad, for instance, though, that the transfer development rights don't work better, because I think that piece, and that I firmly believe, based on some of the research I've done, I did a study on concurrency in Miami, and one of the things you find is that you've got to get concurrency for a long time had been criticized for encouraging sprawl. And I would actually argue, and I actually found in research in Miami, that it may have incurred sprawl for single family housing, but it actually incurred multifamily housing within the urban growth boundary. And that would be the intended effect of that law. So the common sense, common on the street wisdom was not necessarily actually reflecting what was happening. But I think and transfer development rights is in a sense related to that, in that if we have too much development approved for the market to absorb over a period of time, there won't be any value associated with the ability to transfer development rights.
So just to follow up on that, and anyone who wants to respond to this, would you all, or any of you, generally agree that compact development, i.e. that urban clustering that we were just referring to, is more fiscally responsible for county or municipalities than the alternative of sprawl? And just a couple other thoughts there along those same lines. Are there other ways that state or local agencies are part of contributing to that problem? And then finally, any thoughts you may have on the recent repeal by the legislator of the Boundary Adjustment Act that relates to that same point?
Okay. I'm glad I'm here.
There's lots of questions.
it's obvious. obviously a lot of parts to the question centering around the recognition of, in my opinion, in my primary, a lot of my work, whose responsibility is actually paramount. In the county, in our opinion, in our expectation, the way the state and the cities and municipalities have been set up is that the counties are in essentially the less dense areas and the cities are the more dense areas. And those regulatory environments should be acted upon in that way. What we see in Alachua County and a number of other counties around is because of the desire to restrict sprawl and to encourage compact development, the county gets involved in the municipal style planning or the city style planning in their comprehensive plan and land development code. And therefore they act as the city more than they act as the county. In some areas that I see the counties, they recognize that the cities are the cities and the counties are the counties. We have some very restrictive aspects in our comprehensive plan that center around cities in order to for the county to act as its urban style core with cluster lines and service boundaries and things along those lines. And that's where I see a lot of our county focus situated, whereas it should be there's a many more land area and many more people that are not situated in those areas, and those areas could be or should be maybe annexed and moved into the cities.
Anyone else want to chime in before we move on to some questions from the citizens?
One challenge I see, and it relates directly to the point that Stuart just made, which is that the tricky part about all of this is I don't think when you design your built environment form, when you have your street design laid out, when you've defined your density, and when you define your mix of uses, you've defined a built environment that's going to be in place for a long time until the market conditions change, such that you can change the density or you can change the mix of uses. Changing the street pattern is probably the most difficult, which then suggests that the county, the efforts to create interconnected, more urban, new urbanist style of development in suburban locations is probably not a bad impulse, because if you want those areas to be served by transit 25 years from now when the development pattern is changing, you're going to have that kind of density or that opportunity for density and intensity and mix of land uses.
So unless someone else wants to chime in there, let's move on to a couple questions from the citizens. We have, I believe, the partially hidden, but I'll just read a couple of them out, and then anyone wants to jump in. Shouldn't tall buildings be built with the idea that they will last 100 years? Not sure we have too many tall buildings,
I
but certainly.
I think it's just
so
all
buildings, sorry. There's my dyslexia. Okay, shouldn't all buildings be built with the idea that they will last 100 years? Want to chime in there?
I'll talk about tall buildings and all buildings. as a builder, I would love nothing more than for every building that we build to be last 100 years. I mean, I think that would be wonderful. But, you know, not to beat the dead horse, but is it economically feasible to build every building to last 100 years? You know, the answer is absolutely not. It's just not. It's not what the market can bear. You know, I would add, you were talking about sprawl, and when you the more restrictions and the more, you know, regulations we put on this, it drives the cost up. And when the cost goes up, people are going to find somewhere else to go, hence sprawl and how that happens. And then you get into affordability, and that opens a whole other can of worms. So, you know, I'll let it be at that.
So just a couple other things I'll read off, and then again, anyone who wants to jump in. I'll try and get these right. How do we get the community to offer water-conserving landscapes in new construction? Is the energy efficiency of retail and office buildings starting to be a major consideration for end users in deciding where to rent due to public perception of the cost savings? How do we get our building codes to update quicker as new environmentally sound technologies are developed, such as gray water? And then how do we reduce the heat island effect of parking lots? Maybe just anyone who wants to tackle any of those.
Glenn? This is
the Glenn's got his name. Yeah, The challenge of offering water conservation in the landscape is hard from the building community, especially at the price-sensitive houses. If you think about the cost of sod, which is roughly about 50 cents a square foot, the cost of mulch might be another 25 to 50 cents a square foot, and then the cost of landscaping, which is generally, depending on how you plant it, $2 and $3 a square foot. You understand the dilemma of the builder in terms of preferring to not have a lot of plants and to have primarily sod. The only way I think you can encourage change is probably to have some bit of regulatory interaction, but more importantly, an understanding of some of the choices that are visually palatable, I guess I'll call it. Native plants are wonderful. I use them in a lot of projects, but if you've lived in Florida long enough, you know that things go dormant and they wait and sort of conserve water and energy, and then they come back when the rains hit. That's the nature of life in Florida. Our plants do that, and that's not exactly what is desired to be occurring in the middle of the winter, to have a brownness in your landscape. The Florida Yards and Neighborhoods program for friendly landscapes is one step, but those are primarily principles and a huge list of plants, many of which can be really good and many of which might not be so good based on the choices you make. So the long answer is it's a challenge because each site is different, shade, sun, soils, hydrologic system, and it really requires a smart application of plants in a market where a lot of the installers have a limited understanding of plants. So I think demonstration projects are good. I think not so much demonstrations in front of county buildings, but demonstrations in front of actual homes so homeowners can look at them and see them. But those would be my suggestions of advice. And the easy one for how do we reduce the heat island effect of parking lots is you put more shade, particularly trees, or even if you can afford parking shade or shade structures. But that's about the only way to affect heat island, with urban heat island, in without the provision of shade, you probably are out of luck.
One other way you can do that, Glenn, is with a different SRA index on the pavement itself.
That's true.
You can go to a concrete-based pavement or pavers, everything which costs more than the blackest material that we can purchase. So, but yes, the shading aspect, which is well-regulated and well-controlled and well-required across the board in both city, county, and the university, is to provide that shade in the parking lots themselves. I was going to hit the one on the building codes update quicker for alternative technologies. It's an interesting phrasing of the question because actually all those technologies are available and they're available within the building code. The issue is they're not built, and that ties back to our lead discussion or our water efficiency, water rating systems that we talked about earlier. Is that majority of those style or any style alternative gray water, reuse style water within systems are available. It's a matter of the cost and the economic viability to install those systems and whether they're appropriate or not. For instance, in Florida, we average around 50, or this area of Florida, 50 inches of rain a year. That's not even close enough to irrigate a landscape. So rainwater tanks from the gutters doesn't provide enough water for us to be able to irrigate in our regular time when we would want to, even in a xeriscape style design, just because the volume is just not there from whatever roofs that we may have.
Anyone else? Saw some people writing notes. Any other questions? There's also one more question.
I'll touch the energy efficiency of retail space. And in my personal experience, it is definitely part of the conversation, especially, you know, with private sector clients. You know, obviously with the university and local government entities, it is obviously part of the conversation. But Everybody's very interested in low-E glass. They're interested in insulation, you know, sear of mechanical systems. It's certainly part of what we do every day and what everybody wants to know about. And operating cost, it's part of it. And Stuart touched on it earlier. When you get to, you know, if you want to make it a LEED building, that's a whole other category. But all the parts and pieces that can go into a LEED building, not necessarily certifying it, but just making it as energy efficient as possible without getting the certification and going through that whole process, which costs money not only to submit it, but to design it and engineer it and certify it. So, I mean, energy efficiency is a big deal, for sure.
I'm going to add one thing. In an even better response to the question of water conservation, there was a project I worked on some years ago called Madera on Williston Road. And Madera was designed, it's a small subdivision, 88 lots, and it's quarter acre lots. When we built the first couple of landscapes, we modeled a comparable subdivision nearby, same price point, same lot size and everything in building size. Because of the techniques of both the appliance, WaterStar appliances, but more than anything else, the smaller footprint of sod and the related smaller footprint of irrigation, we used soil moisture sensors to indicate to the controller when to water. And because we limited the clearing of the site so that the native vegetation was there and it looked good and all we did was supplement it, the numbers were astounding. We reduced water consumption by more than 60% using the side-by-side comparison to the other subdivision. So if you can achieve that kind of water conservation in a for-profit market value subdivision, and it's about 60-70% built out, that's a pretty amazing success. And that probably is the best example I can think of extraordinary savings by merely using common sense in the design of the site. By site, I mean lot.
Is that site only or site and building?
The site and building, but the ages of the two, we were not able to get in the homes to know what kind of appliances, but the ages are comparable enough. It's got to be probably 8% the site, you know, the appliances being relatively comparable. WaterStar.
Thank you.
Energy Star,
too, but I'm talking water.
Oh.
So, moving on. You know, a couple panelists at previous discussions, particularly at the last one about natural resources, made the point that you know, when the business community goes out to sell people on Gainesville, moving here, that sort of, you know, relocating their businesses here, one of the main things, other than, you know, whatever funding from, you know, government sources or, you know, subsidies of various sorts, one of the main things that they can use to sell people to relocate here is the quality of life. Quality of life includes, you know, not only the cost of living and those sorts of factors, but also the environment and natural resources and the springs and the prairie and the, you know, trails and all those things. So given that, and given the fact that, you know, as we said in that beginning policy statement, we believe sustainability must include providing for the economic prosperity of citizens, what are some of the ways that we could better provide for economic prosperity while still protecting the environment? Are there things that we're not doing now that we could be doing to square that circle? Anybody? Fine.
I have a question more than an answer. It occurred to me that I don't understand why the two are mutually exclusive. And then secondly, what is meant by economic prosperity and for whom? Once I know that, then I know how to address where our issues are. But without defining that, I'm not so sure where to go with this question. And, you know, we could take different tacks, I guess, but until that is defined, it's hard to know.
So, you know, I think just to chime in on your first point there, I think in speaking with previous panelists and panelists for this, as well as, you know, staff and citizens, I think most people would agree that you can have both. I guess where the rubber meets the road is, are there ways in which we are currently are there things that we're not doing that would, or that we are doing that make it harder to, as I think, you know, Ivan mentioned earlier, you know, the more restrictions you have, the further that encourages sprawl or, encourages people to move out. So again, maybe the relationship between some of those kinds of issues is what we're trying to get at with that question.
The correlation between the two of those are very difficult to really tie down, depending on which aspect you're dealing with, whether it's the housing aspect or the actual work side. But the real thing that we can sort of look at in whether we can enhance that for our community is to provide the flexibility based on quality data to change or to modify the where one or the other is impacting that need. In other words, are we increasing the cost of the buildings for the economic prosperity of the community by overly restricting the requirements of landscaping, for instance, or by the potential requirement of a sustainability rating system, when the reality is that you're not really, the community's prosperity would be reduced by requiring it rather than the minor change that you're actually going to get from that requirement when it's actually going to be built that way without having the requirement in the code to get there. And so the flexibility to assess either projects or the use is where we can make some gains on it. Other than that, we've done pretty well.
So unless someone else wants to add there, I think we've been talking about, you know, these rating systems and things like that. According to the U.S. Energy Information Administration, the building sector consumes nearly half of all energy produced in the United States. 75% of all the electricity produced in the United States is used just to operate buildings. Given those kinds of figures, what are we doing locally to increase energy efficiency or water efficiency? Again, we've talked about this a little bit. Are there low-hanging fruits, Teresa, maybe, other than the education that you mentioned of technicians or those people out in the field? Are there other things that we could be doing, either from a regulatory or other, you know, education perspective that, to address some of those issues?
It's like, wow.
If you were queen for the day, what would you recommend?
If I was queen for the day, yes. I would get everybody trained in the same way. No. There's a lot of things that we can do that are behavior, but by the same token, we have to somehow get the people, more people, to be interested. So if I could solve that, I'd be like president.
So no easy solutions is what
you're
saying.
No, I mean, that's the...
Huh? We're debating whether queen would be better than president.
I'm not sure I can help with that discussion.
Yeah, there you go.
Sure.
The aspect of energy use is a really tough discussion, and I know Teresa spends all her day trying to figure out how to train more people in order to understand energy use and understand how it can be better, but it almost goes back to my previous discussion of the flexibility and the ability and the economic viability to be able to make those choices. Whether we decide to put in PV units and do net metering or restrict the number of net meters or restrict the number of PV units that we can have in the net metering aspect is part of the market, but the ability to be able to do it and install those style units with a straightforward process through the building code where there's not an over-restriction aspect of how many permits that need to be obtained, how many inspections, and what work needs to be done to get through that. So there's, you know, obviously that side of it, but also in our overall use of the central style systems, it's an individual personal choice on the education side of how we want to attack that, and increasing prices or regulating us to have less use is not the way to do it. It's the education side, in my opinion.
Anyone else want to add anything? If not, Teresa?
Yeah, I do. 27,000 pairs of hands every day turning stuff on and off. So that's the scope. So just trying to get all the children and then the 4,000 teachers and staff to all do the same thing, it's impossible. And I can teach and preach, but that's why I was just overwhelmed with the question. I can't even get all those folks, much less everybody in their house, and I've only got 42 schools. So.
So maybe we'll take one more question from the citizens and then take a quick break to get some drinks, get some pizza for about 5 or 10 minutes. So we'll take this, I think where we ended was this park and ride question. So park and ride would probably work, it's maybe more of a comment. Park and ride would probably work at a start of a trip, but how would it work when persons have multiple stops? Gainesville is very spread out. So Ruth, I don't know, you were talking a little bit about park and ride. Stuart, if you want to.
I think that's the classic challenge of transit anyway, anywhere. And what we do find is people who live, there's starting to be evidence that people who live further out are much more likely to change their trips than people who live in a rich, mixed-use environment, because we can more easily access the things you need.
Great. Well, if we want to take about 5 to 10 minutes, let's say 10, give everyone a chance to grab a drink, grab some things to eat, mingle, chat, we'll reconvene.
27,000 pairs of hands. 4,000 teachers.
Okay.
But you could just fathom that, right?